from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You may not want to talk string theory over dinner or basic science at the barbecue, but we all know how deep science has changed our world and what a giant role American science has played in those changes. Again, last week, there were lots of Americans named as the latest Nobel Prize winners in science. But there was also a warning from those winners. Heads up, America. You're risking your standing in big, basic science. This hour on Point, Nobel Prize winners speak out on American science now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we still doing enough of the basic science that built the world we live in today? Are we shortchanging science in these times of austerity? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a few moments, we will speak with Bruce Stillman, president and CEO at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, where he's been sounding the alarm on the need for more basic science research. But joining me first are two brand spanking new Nobel Prize winners announced just last week. James Rothman shares this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine, along with two other American researchers. He is professor of biomedical sciences and chemistry at Yale University, chairs the Department of Cell Biology there. He joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Rothman, congratulations and welcome. Welcome, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here with you.
It's wonderful to have you. And with us from Los Angeles, we're joined by Aria Warshall, one of three American dual citizen winners of this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Dr. Warshall, congratulations to you, sir, and thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you both. James Rothman, let me come first to you. That was a big haul of Nobel Prizes last week and some wonderful work behind it. And we were kind of surprised to hear how quickly this message, though, came out. You know, everybody's happy to have it. Everybody's happy to talk about their work. But this warning bubbling up from you and others, hey, heads up, USA, you can't count on this in the next generation if we don't do something differently now. What's your concern, Dr. Rothman?
Well, I think, as you pointed out in your introduction, Tom, the fact that virtually all of the prize winners this year, I've had a chance to listen to many of the press conferences, not just the folks that you have on this program today, have singled this out, really tells you something. It's not like we got together and planned this in advance because, you know, really, you don't know that you're going to get a Nobel Prize.
Right.
Okay. So it really tells you something. And what it boils down to is that Nobel Prizes are a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of work that Dr. Warshall and his colleagues and my co-laureates and the others did is fundamental research that was started in many cases 20 or 30 years ago. And the type of research that opens many doors because it's foundational, the effects are enormous in terms of impact in the case of biomedical research, medicine, the mm-hmm. research that Aria and his colleagues have done has impacted enormously the development of drugs and will continue to do so. But at any one moment in time, it's a little hard to measure the impact. And so there's a huge competition, in a way, for resources now because the federal budget is, as we know, under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And science, especially basic science, we need to pay attention to it. It's not so much an entitlement as it is an investment necessity.
All right, I want to turn to you here, but James Rothman, first, just deal with just this question. You were starting the research that won you and your co-laureates last week, the Nobel Prize, back in the 1970s. If you were a young researcher heading into science today, would you have flowed as easily? Would you be able to do that kind of research all those years ago that last week won you the Nobel? Would it be possible now?
Well, it certainly would in certain other countries in the world. And in our country, it would be more of a challenge. And I'm very saddened to say that. You know, in the late 1970s, when I started my own lab at Stanford University, you know, if you had some reasonable education, you went to a good department, you had a 50% shot of getting an NIH grant. And that NIH grant in current dollars, I'm guessing, would be larger than most NIH grants are now for senior investigators.
National Institutes of Health. Aria Warshall, you know this world well. I mean, you and your fellow laureates in the Chemistry Prize, lots of dual citizenships. Yours, American-Israeli. Michael Levitt, American-Israeli-British. Martin Karplis at Harvard, American and Austrian. Great, you know, that dual citizenship, I guess, is in part there in all of those, Arya, because this country has been such a magnet for great scientists. Is it still? Is this still the place to do the great basic research, sir?
It's a relatively hard question because obviously the NIH grants are much smaller, and it seems that in some cases people are going to do research in China or Singapore. So, but the main concern is young people starting here who, in order to get tenure, for example, have to show that they got some grant, and now it's become almost a lottery. So I'm very familiar with limited resources and with the difficulty to select who to support, except that it's extremely hard to predict which research will succeed. And there is always competition between big science of putting a lot of money in one field to supporting individual. So the answer to your question is that probably still America attracting a lot of people, but some people, let's say from Europe, think twice before they apply here.
And from China, from Singapore, elsewhere, is there a need to come to the United States, or can they do the real basic research as well at home, Arya?
No, I mentioned China and Singapore because a lot of people actually goes there to supplement their research. So there is a huge competition by the Chinese to attract people to give them big labs or centers. And so I'm still not sure, maybe young, bright Chinese will still come here, but clearly money talk, opportunity talk, so there are people who essentially go from the USA to China or Singapore. The good news is that in Europe there is not too much money. So
great.
It evens up.
James Rothman, I can imagine people listening, you know, Americans historically, certainly in the lifetimes of those alive today, have been quite generous with science, and it's had huge payoffs for this country. But I can imagine people listening saying, well, look, you know, globalization is happening. Any number of new countries are coming into their own. We're not going to have the kind of monopoly on research that we may have had for a few decades, nearly after World War II. This is just natural. This is okay. This is just a natural kind of spreading of the wealth. What do you say to that, James?
Well, to people who have those views, I say in general, this is a great country, and we can decide, do we want to continue to make it the greatest country in the world or not? And that's sort of an attitude, not just towards science, but towards every aspect of society and economy. I can't subscribe to that defeatist attitude.
Is it defeatist? I mean, does it matter where science comes from? Talk with us about the stakes.
Well, it does in a way, because there's a huge economic benefit in the long run. In my arena, it's the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries, mm-hmm. and far more that are the envy of the world. So, yes, we could allow globalization of those industries to happen too. It has, but the high-value centers still remain in the United States and to some extent in North America. You know, Tom, if I could say that, I don't want the public to get the idea that these are a bunch of scientists shilling for more dollars like every other lobby group,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because we're not. I actually think there are two issues. One issue is how much money is going to research and development, and the other is how it's allocated within the pot that exists.
Mm-hmm.
And they're two separate issues. On the one hand, as Dr. Stillman has written extensively in various arenas, and this is well known, the NIH budget in real terms after the doubling in the late 1990s and early 2000s, mm-hmm. after the doubling has been reduced, gradually eroding in real terms, in real purchasing power, into the double digit. It's been reduced by the double digit range. And so that's one issue. It would be far better to have an R&D budget that was competitive, growing organically, mm-hmm. perhaps at a modest few percent, okay,
mm-hmm.
That would be reliable, a few percent above inflation, that is.
Yep.
That would be great. But that's only part of the problem, because there's also been a sea change in how the money is allocated. It's happened gradually over more than a decade. And what's happened is progressively more and more of the funds have been allocated to top-down big science projects where the government really is organizing what should be done in one or another way. There's been more and more applied research. And actually, that was all needed. It was all needed. And we all called for it. But sometimes the pendulum goes a little too far. And I actually think it's time that we have a reexamination of whether there's been mission drift of the NIH from its start, which was all about scientific investigation initiated by an individual scientist with a good idea and giving the scientist a chance to succeed, but also understanding that most good science fails because it's on the cutting edge. And I would really call on the administration today to initiate a top-to-bottom review, fully external to the NIH, of the way a transparent review in which we come to understand the funding patterns, the priorities, and we have an open reexamination of how these priorities may exist.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American science, deep science, breakthrough science, and where it's going or not going these days. Talking with a couple of brand spanking new Nobel Prize winners in science. Dr. James Rothman, he shares in the Nobel Prize for Medicine as of last week. Aria Warshall is with us, shares in the Nobel Prize for Chemistry as of last week. There were lots of Americans on those lists. Very first announcement came out a week ago Monday. The Nobel Prize Committee for Physiology or Medicine. Here's the announcement.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute has today decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine jointly to James Rothman, Randy Scheckman, and Thomas Sudhoff for their discoveries of machinery regulating vesicle traffic, a major transport system in our cells.
Americans all in the very first announcement last week, and there would be more to come. All kinds of American universities being named as all this rolled out. James Rothman is professor of biomedical sciences and chemistry at Yale. Aria Warshall is at the University of Southern California, a fellow at the National Academy of Science, right on down that list. But this theme that came out of so many of their first responses, watch out, America. We've got trouble on the science front. We've got all kinds of response online here. Allison says, in my family, there's a newly minted PhD in molecular immunology who left the field, unable to find a job after finishing the degree. Aria Warshall, is not what any country wants to hear, a newly minted PhD in molecular immunology just saying, forget it, I can't find a job.
It's probably even worse if it's a newly or finishing postdoc who left the field after trying for 4 years to find a job. On the one hand, with limited resource, it does happen, and we could be even blamed to generating too many postdocs and PhD in order to push the research. But on the other hand, unless you pick almost at random a postdoc or PhD above a given level and keep them around, you will not be able to generate a new science. I completely agree with James. It's much easier to define a goal like reaching the moon or curing cancer and just say, okay, we have a center that will try to do it. This center will have to continue approaches that are already around, and maybe it won't cure any cancers. But there is the other direction of individual small groups who are supported to some level, and eventually, statistically, one of them will make a major breakthrough. And this is where I have more concern, because it is harder to identify mm-hmm. where the breakthrough will come from. Mm-hmm. And there should be a mechanism. First of all, you don't want people who see that their friends did not get tenure or any job jumping the boat relatively early. I mean, they might even not do the best in the postdoc. So just preventing the system from sudden collapse is probably a major mission.
It's so interesting to hear this from brand new Nobel laureates. James Rothman, is this, you know, it's sort of a moment where you guys do your work, you talk with each other, and then the Nobels come and there's a huge spotlight. You must have felt it like crazy in the last week, and suddenly we get a little glimpse of the chatter in your world, and it's not that common at this level of prominence. Is this a common conversation among top American scientists these days?
All the time, Tom. All the time, everywhere I go. All the time.
How can this be? You guys are smart.
I just got to ask you a question, though. How come you keep referring to spanking in connection with the Nobel Prize? Because I'm wondering if you know something that I don't know.
No, it's all strokes and glory. We're just trying to emphasize just how newly minted you are. Okay, enough of the spanking.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. You know, I just want to comment to the person who wrote in about the newly minted PhD.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very sorry to hear that. Unfortunately, it's a very, very common story at every level. But actually, I want to make sure people understand it's not about employment. This is not entitlement. You know, what it really is about, mm-hmm. and it's about opportunity, it's about proven track record for what science does for American the American economy and American society. We are, as you said in your introduction, the magnet of the world. We have been. And we can decide whether to have that continue or not. Now, when people like Arya and I and Bruce say we need to have, more, it's easy to say, oh, these guys just want more. Everybody wants more. These are tough times, and we all understand that. We're not looking for a big increase. We're looking for just sort of returning to steady predictability so careers can be predicted. And having said that, I don't think we should be throwing all of the cold water at the NIH. It's also our academic research institutions. There's a new reality. The new reality, which is part of the larger American reality, is that we're more in a steady state mode with more global competition than ever. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really made adjustments, any of the institutions, to operating more in a steady state mode than in a rapid growth mode.
What would adjustment look like, ideally, then?
Well, certainly at the NIH level, what it would mean, as I was indicating, is steady, predictable growth
instead
over
of
multiple
erratic
years.
Okay.
Right. It also means probably focusing more on the scientist and less on the project. In other words, people who have a proven track record on the one hand, they require longer-term consistent investment in the way, for example, that the Germans and the Swiss do so well, mm-hmm. where science is prospering even within a European retrenchment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's also about, as Arya said, the young scientists. You have to give them a pass for about 5 years. At the moment, when we start out a scientist at Yale, and the same is probably true at USC, mm-hmm. Where Arya is, we hire a young scientist. We put a lot of effort into recruiting them and understanding that they're really very good. And then we actually have skin in the game. We typically invest one or two or even more $1 million in someone right out of their training to help them set up their own lab. And then we say, attaboy, you go at it. Okay.
Yep.
Now, in the past, that would work really well because the chances of that person getting an NIH grant after just 1 or 2 years were very good. Today, and I've recruited almost 15 junior faculty to Yale in the last 5 years, mm-hmm. and our biggest worry is their ability to take the big risks over a five-year period, as I did. You asked at the outset what would happen to me. I didn't have any degree of acceptance of my project by my peers generally, and rightly so.
The project that has now won you a Nobel Prize.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. And that would have, in those days, I was given lots of attaboys and keep at it at year 2, 3, 4, and 5. Today, as the department chair, I'd have to have a discussion with the junior faculty member about what's going to happen at year 3. Okay. And we would do our very best to sustain that person. And that comes to the institutions.
But what's the difference? I mean, you're saying even back then, people might have seen you as a little bit out on a limb or I don't know.
The difference is that right off the gate, I got a 5-year NIH grant.
Okay.
And in the dollars in absolute terms, Bruce and I were comparing notes on this recently about our grants because we're Bruce Stillman, your other
We'll bring him in just a second here, yeah.
I hope so because he has a lot to add.
Mm-hmm.
We had we were funded at a level that a senior scientist would be happy with for 5 years, and now a senior scientist would get a portion of that at today for maybe 3 or 4 years. And so we had that opportunity. Today, the startup package, as generous as they are, get the young person out of the gate for a couple of years, and then there's a problem. And so that's where the institutions come in, and the institutions also need to have a hard look at how they allocate resources. We really need to reexamine the system from top to bottom, and I have to say I don't feel it's happening.
The startup
package. It's absolutely important that we look at the entire ecosystem from top to bottom in an unprejudiced way.
Well, we are listening right here today, brand spanking new or not. You guys are big and incredibly accomplished and, in a way, representative of a powerful generation of American science when it was, everybody agreed, really working. Today, lots of questions about it. James Rothman, Aria Warshall, both brand new Nobel Prize winners. Please stand by. Bruce Stillman joins us now from New York. He's president, chief executive officer of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, succeeding Nobelist James Watson there. Member of the National Academy of Sciences, big in the world of science, big voice on this issue. Bruce Stillman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what's your explanation about why is it that when brand new Nobel Prize winners get together, the first thing they would want to talk about after, wow, isn't this amazing, I suppose, is the state of American science? What's going wrong?
Well, I think the one thing the Nobel Prize does, and I want to congratulate both Jim and Aria and the other laureates this year for their spectacular science and careers. So, I think the Nobel Prize is rather unique because it gives a voice to scientists in the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as Jim said before, scientists are talking about these problems all of the time. It is something that is ingrained in the national culture of science now. And it's a real pity. I, too, came to the United States about 35 years ago from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I came and stayed here was that the United States is one of the few countries in the world where scientists have the opportunity to do their own work and be innovative. And there's a culture of innovation that has existed in the United States, not just in science, but in lots of different areas.
Lucky us.
That doesn't exist in a lot of countries. And everybody talks about, you know, China and mm-hmm. Singapore and that. The culture is very, very different there. So this is a place where young scientists can come, as Jim Rothman did, as I did, and as many others have done, and really do investigator-initiated research and pursue their own goals, that some of which, or many of which, have a huge impact.
Is something going wrong with that culture of innovation?
Well, what's happening now is because of the huge competition to get federal grant support. Even 10 years ago, you had about 1 in 4 chance of getting a grant. Nowadays, it's around about 1 in 8 chance of getting a grant. And the success of getting a grant is counted even if you pursue that for 3 years and then eventually get a grant. The federal government counts that as a success. Well, we don't count that as a success. And the point of this is that if you're going to have this amount of competition, there's no real rational assessment of what can be funded. There's a lot of really good science that's not getting funded, and we're losing scientists to other countries because of this competition.
This heightened competition for grants, is it because there's more competition for grants or fewer grants, less grant money?
Well, proportionally, there's less grant money than there has been. Since 2002, the NIH in particular, is down 16% in real dollars. And part of this is because the federal government and Congress haven't passed a budget for 5 years, and they're not prioritizing national priorities. They're not saying, well, if we invest in science, then this is going to help the economy. This is going to keep the United States on the leading edge of producing, not only in biomedical sciences, but if you look at companies like Apple, all of the technology that went into an iPhone is an incredible amount of interesting physics and engineering
sure.
that happened in this country. And if we lose that leadership, then I think the innovation culture here will gradually disappear, because what's happening with getting even if you get a grant, you get it for a shorter period of time now and you get cut. And therefore, you have to renew that grant, and you tend to do scientists are really forced to do incremental type of research.
Why the short leash? Why this evolution toward, you know, less time? Why?
Well, because with the unpredictability, Jim Rothman mentioned this before, and it's something I've written about, we cannot predict where the federal budget for science is going to be even now a year ahead, let alone 5 years ahead. And scientists and institution leaders have to plan and think about the larger picture. And we can't do that now. So what's happening is to try and fund more scientists, the NIH and the National mm-hmm. Science Foundation and others are providing grants to scientists, but they're providing less money and they're providing it for a shorter period of time, which generates this culture of what I call incremental short-term results to get your grant renewed rather than do the type of innovative science that we see has been awarded, you know, recognized in this year's Nobel Prize.
James Rossman, this sounds like a kind of spin-off cost of the very kind of crazy gyrations we're seeing in Washington right now. Who would think that it could, you know, have knock-on effects that go all the way to basic science? But that's exactly what Bruce Stillman's describing here.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I get a lot of questions these days about what is the effect of shutdown, sequester. Obviously, shutdown's not good for anybody, and we all hope that the insanity in Washington will resolve quickly. Sequester is related to that. It will eventually go away, we hope. But what Bruce and I are talking about are underlying long-term issues mm-hmm. that relate to both the scale of the budget as a whole and how that budget is allocated for investigator-initiated research, which means the young person has a good idea, wants to take a risk, put his or her career on the line with that risk. Okay?
But this isn't just about default and shutdown. If you can't even have budgets for year after year that allow science to plan on the scale and timetable that it needs to plan, that sounds like not a good petri dish full of policy.
That is absolutely it's a fundamental issue. And what I'm trying to emphasize mm-hmm. is that in addition to that fundamental issue, there is a second equally fundamental mm-hmm. issue. And that second equally fundamental issue is how in a relatively flat growth mode,
yep.
okay, as incremental growth mode, how we allocate the resources for basic science versus applied research. And if you look back at the great advances in healthcare, for example, my father's generation,
yep.
I'm 62. Mm-hmm. If it was 1955, I'd have probably had my first heart attack by now. Okay?
Great.
And yet my dad lived to 90. Mm-hmm. Okay? Why? Okay? Because blood pressure and cholesterol were controlled. We don't think about heart disease. It's very important. We think as much about cancer now. More people die of cancer. Why? Less people are dying of heart disease. The mm-hmm. good news is that people live longer, and therefore they're more likely to get cancer. Okay? That's the bad news.
Yeah, the good news is they live longer. But the point is, do the science, it changes life.
Well, you see, the thing is that why is it we can control cholesterol and blood pressure? It's because in the 1940s and 1950s, Conrad Bloch, another Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, discovered the pathway of cholesterol synthesis.
Do the science now or pay later. James Rothman, Aria Warshall, Bruce Stillman, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about American science, deep science, breakthrough science, and where it's going or not going these days with a couple of brand new Nobel Prize winners in science. Dr. James Rothman shared the Nobel Prize for medicine last week. Dr. Aria Warshall shared the Nobel Prize for chemistry. Here's the announcement of that prize made last Wednesday by Stefan Normark, permanent secretary of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Listen to all the USA in here.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Chemistry to Professor Martin Karplus at Université de Strasbourg, France, and Harvard University, Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA, and Professor Michael Levitt at Stanford University School of Medicine, California, USA, and Professor Ari Warshall at University of Southern California, Los Angeles, USA. And the Academy Citation runs for the development of multiscale models for complex chemical systems.
There it is. Yet another big lineup. USA, USA, however you want to say it, it's American. But what about the pipeline? What about where we're headed? That's the question on the table here with these two brand new Nobel Prize winners. Plus, Bruce Stillman is here. He's CEO of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, where they think a lot about the future of science and American science. James Rothman, Arya Warshall, Bruce Stillman, we've kept a lot of listeners waiting. Let's turn to some of them. Sarah, Framingham, Massachusetts, thank you for calling, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Long-time listener and big fan of yours.
Great to have you.
I just wanted to give you two quick comments about my experience. I just graduated in May, and I've been applying all over the place to different research jobs. And this is just kind of a job that I think used to be so much easier to get, you know, that in-between college and grad school research assistant type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I've been shocked at the experience I've been having the past couple of months, because every time I find a great lab, something I'm really interested in, is the same response every single time. You sound perfect. We need you. We have somebody who's doing your job and also doing another two jobs, and they absolutely need you, but we can't hire you because our funding just got cut. You know, and if you would have called us 3 years ago, it would have been a totally different story.
And there you are. So are you sticking with it? What are you in? Biology, did you say, Sarah?
Biology, exactly.
And so what's your plan at this point?
Well, the plan was to do a couple of years of research and then go from there to medical school.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't know if that part's going to happen. And I have plenty of research experience. You know, I have like 3 years of research experience already. But to start full-time, you know, and that hasn't been happening. And it just reminds me of, like, back when the debate used to be every day, when I think it was Mitt Romney who said, you know, about how to work the budget and how to allocate resources. And he said something along the lines of, if we don't want to borrow money from China, then we should cut this. You know, like, should we cut PBS? Should we cut radio and TV and things that are government funded? And it's just shocking to me that the most basic research is being cut. It's not like, you know, it's not like it's not translational research. It's very important and translational, and it's not like obscure research.
Yeah, Sarah, we got it. Let us pick it up. We wish you luck with that. There's Sarah with her brand new degree, and can't find the sort of next rung on the ladder to help her move on. Let me read to new Nobel laureates and Bruce Stillman. Here's another along those same lines. This is from Beast Best, who's further down the road, says, you have to be crazy to pursue academic research at this point. You really have to decide there's no alternative you can live with. Sounds like starting out to be a poet. Writes, I'm a third-year postdoc, and the Tea Party right has forced me to read the tea leaves. I'm going into biotech to make enough money to raise a family after a six-year PhD, and now in my third year of postdocing, I just can't afford to continue. People don't get faculty positions until they're in their late 30s, early 40s. It's too hard. And this listener goes on to say, but there's another problem. The entire PhD postdoc process in the U.S. is completely broken in ways that have nothing to do with financing. It's a horrific system of mentoring, limited guidance on what's required for success, abusive uses of trainees with workloads approaching slavery. It's a broken system from the top down. This is good. I mean, we don't want to hear that kind of report from our young scientists in this country, James Rothman.
No, we don't. I'm not sure I quite concur with that. That sounds like a little bit of an overly dramatic description. But and I would hoping that my postdoctoral fellows wouldn't
don't
agree
feel
to
that
it.
Way. Okay,
but there is what it does illustrate is the frustration that young scientists feel. And you know, if I could say, Tom, I think we have a challenge of historical proportions. If you look at, you know, we think that we're really great, you know, and we are actually pretty good. But if you say historically, how long have we really been so dominant in science?
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, it really starts pretty much after World War II.
Which is not that long ago, Vannevar Bush and the endless frontier.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And there's a reason for it, okay? Before that time, we were sort of a pimple on the back of science globally. For example, Robert Oppenheimer, if you read his biography, the great physicist, he went and trained in Europe. There was no physics on the scale of what happened in Europe, nor chemistry, nor biology, nor medical research.
Mm-hmm.
It was all happening in Europe. Then Adolf Hitler happened. And, of course, that was an enormous tragedy for the world. But it accrued ultimately, in terms of science, to the benefit of the United States.
Because he chased scientists out of Europe who came here.
Almost all. If you look at the previous generation of Nobel laureates 20 mm-hmm. years ago,
mm-hmm.
they're almost all immigrants who, if they were fortunate enough to survive, many of them Jewish, frankly,
mm-hmm.
they brought the European tradition here and they transplanted it. Before that, we were a very practical nation. We invented the cotton gin.
Right.
You know, we didn't invent the wireless. Marconi did, but we made better radios. We didn't discover the X-ray, but we sure did make X-ray machines.
Well, are you suggesting culturally we could backslide into cotton gin building, which is good,
exactly,
but not
Tom.
Enough?
I'm suggesting I'm raising the possibility that we are in danger of not having adopted the European culture and truly internalized it and returning to our culture of short-term pragmatism, which has always been our history. It's also been great. We're inventive.
Yeah.
We are technologists, not necessarily basic science developers. And I don't think we need to go that direction. But if we don't watch it, that's exactly what we're going to do. And Asia, though the culture right now is not all that well suited to be competitive at the highest levels, that is changing rapidly. And in another 20 years, you'll be hosting this program from Beijing.
Okay. long may it wave, but I'd rather do it here. Thank you. Arya Warshall, I mean, you and many other top scientists do research not just in the United States, but you also do work abroad as well. I think you do some in Israel. What about this issue of culture? I mean, we've had decades where that combination of the breakthrough dream and American prosperity, American money, made this a great place to be. Do we have cultures that are going to be competing for that leading edge success seat, Arya?
Essentially, the postdoc who complained before
mm-hmm.
Kind of gave me the opposite conclusions that he had. In order to push in science, you really don't, you should not give up, which means that in a minute I will talk on why people could give up. So just complaining that it will be harder to feed your family if you are in this stage, I don't think, should watch what I'm saying, I don't think you should stay in science. So you need the drive. But,
yeah, but wait,
I
want to hear the rest, but can we just sit with that for a second? Because of course we
yes.
need the drive, but you know, human nature, if you put too large a hill in front of someone, they may not be able to go over it. I mean, isn't part of the reason for our success coming out of the time when you and James are doing your research that there was a system that did support you?
Okay, but what I wanted to say mm-hmm. is that if you are an assistant professor and 10 of your grant requests are denied, this is when you probably might decide to give up. I mean, this is where I sit on committees and see mm-hmm. people who submit many NIH grants and decline,
mm-hmm.
and they are really good. So this is where it's too much, and really good people, I'm not judging this guy, and I'm always very hard
sure.
on people who say that I have to take my kids to the kindergarten and I come at 11 o'clock, but if you keep failing in submitting grants, this is a point where you could destroy science. So there is a level of support and mainly a long-range support. I mean, you cannot just write applied grants in the hope that this will work rather than continue in your main dream. So the main point mm-hmm. is that the long-range research, like in England at the Medical Research Council, they kept people for 30 years. Almost no need for grants, and each of them got Nobel Prize. So it's not only the culture which required tenacity, but also some confidence that you don't have to think for tomorrow of submitting a new grant.
Yeah, which is not where we are now. Bruce Stillman, do
yes.
you see that tenacity still in American culture? And what about James Rothman's warning that, hey, America, You know, you were for a long time very pragmatic innovators, but not necessarily pushing the frontiers of science, and you could become that again, USA.
Well, I think the just a comment on the postdoc that said he was going to go into biotech. If there's not enough support of basic science in the United States, there won't be a biotech industry down the road. So that's where all of the discoveries come from.
All tied up together, yeah.
Yeah, it is very much tied up together. And I think the nation has to realize that science is probably one of the most powerful economic drivers of any of the pursuits that government can support. I really think that the innovation that I talked about before and the passion for science that Aria was talking about is really something that has to be ingrained in a scientist. And if you don't have that, then you're not going to succeed. And in fact, scientists becoming successful in science is the same in any other field of pursuit. It is a Darwinian process. There's a selection for those that are really good. Not everybody can do it. It's not a birthright to become a scientist and a successful and funded scientist. Mm. It's a privilege to be funded by the federal government and taxpayers. And also in this country, there's a very, very strong tradition of philanthropic support of science, which doesn't exist elsewhere. And in my opinion, most of the innovation and the innovative discoveries are nowadays supported by private money and not by the federal money for the reasons I was talking about before.
There's a change. So let me ask you this, Bruce. Do you see a risk that this country will slide away from this sort of, you know, brilliant half-century-plus post-World War II Vannevar Bush world, turbocharged by a lot of scientists who came from Europe? Could we slide away from that? I mean, you've already got people saying, you know, Peter Thiel and others saying, we're not doing the big breakthroughs anymore. Maybe we've already slid away from it. Could the Nobel Prizes 30 years from now just not have many USA stamps on them?
Well, I'm actually an optimist, and I think that eventually what is going to happen is that the public will demand that Congress actually do something about making priorities, and that science, I think even most members of Congress will support research and development, federal funding for research and development. I think this process just has to get fixed. We're going through a very bizarre period in American politics at the moment. But I'm optimistic that this country will remain very innovative and will continue to support science. Going back to Vannevar Bush, you know, the United States came out of one of the most catastrophic events in the history of the country, and that is the World War II. And what did the government say then? They said, we should not support applied research, short-term goal research. We should support basic research that has very broad and goals that are going to break the new ground and discoveries like that. That is what happened then. I think this can happen again. It is going to take leadership. It's going to take leadership from scientists, as well as trying to convince some of our nation's leaders to take on this as an issue, because it is really at the root of the future of the economy and the leadership of the United States.
Another call or two here. Jay in Columbus, Georgia. Jay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A few months ago, I saw a special report by Dan Rather where he was talking about the abundance of scientists that we have that are lingering throughout our universities, and they have no outlet to continue to grow. So the interest of science in America seems to me is surely there and bubbling, but there's another area it goes into. Well, why is it that scientists have to become so nationalized? And I'm glad that there's the dual citizenships going on, because America can be producing scientists, and why not provide opportunities and negotiations so these scientists can go abroad and help develop and help other countries to evolve as well, as opposed to us just being a developed country.
Jay, I hear it. That's very interesting. Let me bring it to our Nobel laureates, James Rothman. There's a globalist who says, let's not be nationalistic about our science. If there's more opportunity elsewhere, go and pursue it there, you know, for the good of the world. What do you say, James?
Well, I mean, let's put some numbers on it. For example, I would say a large fraction of the NIH budget today is going to support foreign nationals
who've come
in the United
States
on training. Mm-hmm. I would guess I'm guessing it's certainly over a third, and it may be a half. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if we pick one major recipient of the benefit of that, China, they don't disclose their numbers, but from what I know, their total biomedical research budget is a small fraction of ours, maybe a tenth. Okay, so if you put those numbers together, we may be spending more already.
We are subsidizing there.
And then when you add in the whole immigration fiasco, we're showing them the door, more or less.
Because we don't allow them to stay. Yeah.
Exactly. And so this comes to the point of structured for success. We really need to ask, are we structured for success going forward? Not just the amount of money, but how we spend it.
There is a big heads up from brand new Nobel laureates, and not just the two with us today, but loud and clear from them, Dr. James Rothman at Yale University, winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize for Medicine. Our time's up, but we really appreciate the heads up. Thank you very much for being with us today, Jim.
Thank you.
And Arya Warshall, winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize for Chemistry, joining us from USC in California. Arya, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Bruce Stillman, CEO of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, thanks as well to you for joining us, Bruce.
That's a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Let's listen and learn right here. Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.